KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shea Stevens. The U.S. Senate has voted to confirm Kash Patel as the new director of the FBI. Patel's controversial nomination was pushed over the line despite fierce opposition from Democrats. NPR's Ryan Lucas has more.
The Republican-led Senate confirmed Patel by a vote of 51-49 to lead the FBI, the nation's most powerful law enforcement agency. Two Republican senators, Maine's Susan Collins and Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, joined all Senate Democrats in opposition. Patel is a former prosecutor and was a national security official in Trump's first term. He's also a Trump loyalist and fierce critic of the FBI. His Republican supporters say he will fix what they argue is the politicization of the FBI against conservatives. Patel's critics, meanwhile, say he lacks the necessary experience and temperament to lead the Bureau, and worry that he will use the FBI's vast powers to make good on his repeated threats to go after his and Trump's perceived enemies. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge has rejected a request from five unions seeking an injunction to block mass layoffs at federal agencies. U.S. District Court Judge Christopher Cooper says the plaintiffs should have taken their complaint to the Federal Labor Relations Authority and not federal court. Senate Republicans are pulling an all-nighter to advance their budget resolution. As NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports, President Trump favors the House's approach to implementing his agenda.
The Senate and the House are pursuing different strategies in helping the White House get more funding for the southern border and extend the 2017 tax cuts. The House wants to tackle the components in one big bill. The Senate thinks it's more expeditious to split it into two bills, one for now and one later this year. The Senate is undertaking what's known as a votorama, where lawmakers bring amendments often aimed at making members of the other party take challenging votes. It will likely last through the evening and early morning hours of Friday and represents an early phase of a long road ahead. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, The Capitol.
A new report from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration finds that more than a third of the U.S. population lives in drought-stricken areas. NPR's Michael Copley reports that for many areas with unusually dry conditions, the situation may last into spring.
The latest data from NOAA shows drought or abnormally dry conditions across most of the country's lower 48 states. Drought's especially severe in the Southwest, from southern Nevada and California through Arizona and New Mexico and into West Texas. There are also pockets of extreme drought in parts of the Great Plains, including Wyoming, South Dakota, and Nebraska. NOAA says the Southwest is likely to see below normal precipitation through May. Drier conditions this spring could extend up into Colorado, Nebraska, and Wyoming. Michael Copley, NPR News.
U.S. futures are flat in after-hours trading on Wall Street. This is NPR. A U.S. envoy to Ukraine canceled a planned press conference with President Zelensky amid rising tensions. The decision came after retired General Keith Kellogg met with Zelensky in Kyiv. The Ukrainian leader called the gathering productive and says his nation is ready for strong and effective investment and security agreements with the U.S. Three buses exploded in a parking lot in the Israeli city of Bat Yam near Tel Aviv Thursday. Explosives were found in two other parked buses but did not go off. Authorities say there are no reports of any injuries from the blasts, and no group has claimed responsibility for the incident. Some researchers say that lab mice may try to revive unconscious mice when they see them. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports some researchers suspect it may be a form of empathy.
Researchers who anesthetize mice have noticed that other mice sometimes behave strangely towards unconscious individuals. New research published in the journal Science describes this behavior in detail. When presented with an unconscious cage mate, mice exhibit behaviors that start with sniffing and grooming and progress to biting and even tongue pulling. Mice are especially attentive when they know the unconscious mouse. The poking and prodding actually seems to help the knocked out mice regain consciousness faster, the study found. These behaviors were activated by oxytocin circuits in the brain, which have been shown to underlie helping behaviors in other species. The researchers say it could be an instinctual behavior that might have evolved because of its beneficial effects to social groups. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
On Asia-Pacific, market shares are mixed, up nearly 3% in Hong Kong. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Many experts have said that the development of artificial intelligence was going to be nothing if not unpredictable. Well, about that, at least, they were right.
There's a Chinese startup that few people had ever heard of until the past few days, and it has emerged as a real player in the AI arms race. It's called DeepSeek.
The arrival of DeepSeek sparked a frenzy. It immediately threatened the dominance of American AI and generated both public excitement and alarm about the role of AI in our lives.
AI-generated content already floods our information ecosystem, from social media to children's classrooms to family group chats. So is DeepSeek just another feature of this AI landscape, or is it a seismic rift, as some of the buzz suggests? I'm Seth Shostak. Welcome to Big Picture Science.
I'm Molly Bentley. In this, our regular look at critical thinking, Skeptic Check, we have a lot of questions about the latest AI disruptor, including how it might change our relationship with machines and whether it brings us closer to a system that's indistinguishable from human intelligence. To answer these questions, we are going into the DeepSeek.
What was notable about the arrival of DeepSeek on the AI scene is how profoundly it shattered what we thought we understood about the technology. Before its debut, the defining AI model seemed to be OpenAI's ChatGPT. People were impressed with its ability to answer difficult questions, solve math problems, and engage in human-like chat.
Then in January 2025, everything seemed to change. A new AI model appeared, created by the Chinese startup DeepSeek. The company name quickly became synonymous with the model itself. Many who interacted with it were astonished. The Chinese AI model functioned like the American models in many ways, but was cheaper and appeared smarter. It caused a shockwave in the tech industry, and the future of AI now seemed wide open.
But that's our question. Has DeepSeek really changed everything? One tech journalist who covered DeepSeek's jolting arrival helps us understand why it feels like a shakeup in the AI world.
My name is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm a technology reporter, and I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast.
And welcome to Big Picture Science.
I love podcasts that start with big, so it's great to be here.
Alex, the appearance of DeepSeek shook up the AI world. Now, that was then, now we're a little ways down the road. But could you just remind us and take us back to that those first 24 hours? What was it about the arrival of DeepSeek that took the world by storm?
Absolutely. So Silicon Valley has been spending billions of dollars to develop AI models. And all of a sudden, this company called DeepSeek, which had developed some models in the past, releases one that it claims it was able to build with much less money than American firms, and almost more importantly, they were able to run the model much more efficiently, which means that if you are spending $60 to use the model with OpenAI, you were spending $2.19 to use the equivalent amount of technology from DeepSeek. So it was a extreme cost reduction that sort of turned the entire equation of the AI industry on its head and sort of had everybody scratching their heads asking why has it taken American firms so much money to build something that folks in China were able to build for much less and make available for much less.
DeepSeek, the company, put out a paper, I believe, that laid out what they were planning to do. Yet there still was this surprise. And I've heard interviews with you where you say you had to spend that afternoon kind of scrambling to get caught up on what this was. So there was a slow roll, but there was also an element of surprise here.
Well, yeah, it all comes together because they were making some extraordinary claims that this model was able to run more efficiently and that they had built it with much less training. And so what happens is the technologists then need to get their hands on the stuff that they're releasing, look through the paper, see if they could replicate it. And then the amazing thing that happened was the technology was replicated by others independently using the outlines that DeepSeek had provided. So all of a sudden you saw it not just on DeepSeek.com, but in places like Hugging Face, where technologists were able to download it and use it, and then actually in production on websites like Perplexity, which is an AI search engine. So it's one thing to hear a claim from a company that seems pretty outlandish. It's another thing to see others replicate it and then you were starting to literally be able to use it days later.
So it's one thing for scientists to say, biologists, for example, to say, we're going to bring back the woolly mammoth. And it's another to actually put your hand on the fur of that animal. Like, that's quite a claim, but let's wait and see.
That's right, yeah. Silicon Valley was petting the woolly mammoth. That's the way you could think about it.
What was it like to interact with DeepSeek? What kind of questions did you ask it, if that's not too personal?
Yeah, it was pretty fascinating. I mean, one of the things that DeepSeek does that's on the product side different from everybody else is that it spells out its chain of thought. So you could actually see the model working through step by step the answer to your query, as opposed to like a typical LLM large language model like ChatGPT, which uses the GPT model, which is a traditional AI model. You write a question and it just kind of spits it all back. The cool thing about DeepSeek R1, this is the model that everybody's talking about, is you can actually see it go step by step and try to work out the solution to your problem and sort of self-evaluate as it goes down the chain of thought. So I'll talk about one of the examples that I thought was really fascinating, where I saw somebody put a query that said, give me a novel insight about the human condition. And you see DeepSeek literally like work through like the nature of humanity and come to these conclusions. And after it comes to
what do you mean it works through? So it'll say, I'm just thinking about the size of the human brain, or I'm just thinking about the way humans are dependent on tools, and it'll just appear as sort of a thought bubble, or how does it appear? How does this the method of its reasoning actually materialize?
So it actually, I would say this is almost like PhD level sociology that you see it start to go through, where it talks about how we interact with each other and, you know, the selfishness of humans, but also the ability to cooperate. And it's probably like it's read every book on the subject. So I'm sure it's read Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari and every other similar book. And so it's really working through this. And as it comes to each conclusion, it says, well, is that a novel conclusion? Well, not really. So maybe, you know, it's been brought up here. So let's try to go a level deeper.
It's kind of doing the Socratic method on itself, asking questions and then kind of refining its answer and asking other questions.
Absolutely. That's a great way to think about it. And the one that it comes up with is absolutely fantastic.
And Alex, remind me what the question was. What is unique about the human condition?
Yeah. So somebody asked DeepSeek for one truly novel insight about humans. And this is where it ended up netting out after 157 seconds of thought. Humans instinctively convert selfish desires into cooperative systems by collectively pretending abstract rules, monies, laws, and rights are real. These shared hallucinations act as games where competition is secretly redirected to benefit the group, turning conflict into society's fuel.
is it just ripped from the pages of a scholar, or is it actually reasoning?
So I think it's more than just ripped from the pages of a scholar, and that's where when you start to look at the actual chain of thought, you start to get some really interesting insights into the brain of this machine. So here's one.
Ooh, you said brain.
I'm not particularly adverse to anthropomorphizing these bots. I mean, of course, they don't think and they don't have brains like we do, but how else are we going to understand them? I mean, to me, that's totally in bounds and fine, because I do think most of us understand that there is a difference. So I do think it's just very interesting to watch it go through step by step and consider all different possibilities until it comes to its conclusions. And was what it said about the human condition, you know, truly novel? No. And I don't think we have AI that has the ability to come up with unique scientific exploration or thought or insights yet. But I do think that it's going to be a process like this that might get us there.
Well, just by this example, you've shown why DeepSeek took the world by storm. It is engaging. How does it compare to the U.S. chatbots or the U.S. models such as GPT or Claude?
It's far more transparent. I mean, that's the truth, unfortunately. It's more open than OpenAI. OpenAI does have these reasoning models, one called O1 that has a chain of thought. But instead of showing you exactly how it's quote-unquote thinking through a problem, it will just give you the bullet points of what it's thought through, basically summarized. And DeepSeek just lays it all out there. And I think that's been some of the fascinating part of the user experience.
Is that just interesting, Alex, or is that an important distinction?
Well, we don't really know what's going on under the hood with OpenAI, but we can see it with DeepSeek, and I think that's important.
I want to follow up on this idea of open source and just note the irony. I'm not the first to do it, obviously, that the rival U.S. company is called OpenAI, but it is not open source. But, Alex, what is the relationship between transparency and open source? Is transparency giving you a peek into how the model is reasoning, and is open source different in that it sounds like transparency, but really it is making the architecture available to everybody, or are they related?
I think they go hand in hand, but there is a distinction. I mean, to me, transparency is what we see when we're able to see DeepSeek reason through a hard question. Open source is, hey, here, we built this technological innovation. This is how we did it. You can go now, take what we've done, and run with it, and build your own optimizations. So, two different things, but they come from the same ethos, I think, of wanting to share knowledge, of wanting to be transparent, and not holding too much close to the vest. And that's why I think this is an underrated moment for shifting the leadership of AI from these proprietary closed models, like you have with OpenAI and Anthropic's Claude, to open source, because this is what happens. Meta releases a model. DeepSeek reads the paper, downloads the weights, builds their own model, improves upon it. They release DeepSeek R1. Now what do you think is happening in Meta? They have seen what DeepSeek has done. They're going to download everything. They're going to sort of fully unpack it, and they will put the improvements into their next model. That gets released. Then maybe a third open source developer picks out what Meta has done on the back of DeepSeek and improves upon it further. So you have this whole open source community coming together, building and developing and improving these models, while you have OpenAI and Anthropic going at it on their own. And that's why I think the entire DeepSeek moment has been worse. The worst situation has been for OpenAI and its proprietary method of building, and especially Anthropic, which does the same exact thing but doesn't have a hit consumer app like OpenAI has with ChatGPT.
What you just described there of companies sharing information, or maybe not even willfully, but like borrowing from each other, you just described the process of science. Scientists write papers, others try to replicate those experiments, they add to them. That is how science builds knowledge, is adding on previous work. It sounds like that's what this is, but that doesn't explain. Or does that explain why people were feeling like this was a Sputnik moment, that this was really a game changer, perhaps?
I think Sputnik is a bit overblown. I think that was something that Andreessen said, and he's Marc Andreessen, he's the venture capitalist. He's a bit of a showboater, and he likes to make provocative statements and write long blog posts that sometimes are coherent. But look, I think that what we saw was a perfect storm here. We saw a model with true novel innovation over the status quo. We saw that model was open source. Not only that, it was cheaper to run than the proprietary models, and it came from China. And you put those four factors together, right? Open, cheaper, innovation coming from China, and then you start to understand why everybody was shaken when it came out.
Okay, let's get into perhaps the darker side, the dark underbelly of this Chinese model, which is censorship. And there seems to be censorship built into the DeepSeek chatbot. It will not answer questions that the Chinese government considers a threat, at least those that were most asked of it in those early days, which is questions about Taiwan or about Tiananmen Square. This is concerning, Alex, if this is going to be the model for AI chatbots going forward.
Well, look, I will not recommend going to DeepSeek.com and thinking that you're going to, A, keep your data entirely safe, and B, be shown answers without any bias. Those are big questions if you go to DeepSeek.com. What I do recommend is going to Perplexity and selecting the DeepSeek model that they have built in and getting a chance to speak with basically the same model with the censorship removed. And again, that's sort of the beauty of them releasing this open source, is that other companies have taken what they've built and modified and removed and improved upon already what they've done. And you can get the DeepSeek model to answer questions about Tiananmen Square as long as you're not on DeepSeek.com.
Alex Kantrowitz, thank you so much for talking to us. And it's nice to have a human-to-human interaction.
Next time I'll send my bot. But great to see you, Molly.
Alex Kantrowitz is a tech journalist and founder of Big Technology, a newsletter and podcast about the world of tech.
Later in the show, the Hollywood blockbuster where warnings about AI were delivered to the past, which was our present, by the future. Trust me, it makes sense. Kind of.
But first, an AI scientist weighs in on whether the latest thinking machine is bringing us closer to creating AGI, artificial general intelligence.
Have we created a machine that's as smart or smarter than we are? When you interact with it, is it exhibiting the same kinds of intelligent behaviors that you would expect out of a human being?
Next, are we inventing our successors? In this episode of Skeptic Check from Big Picture Science, we are going into the DeepSeek.
A discussion about whether one AI chatbot is smarter than another may seem esoteric, one that's limited to AI circles or experts, but we all have a stake in the development of AI. Who does the developing, and where does it lead?
Hi, I'm Christian Hammond. I'm a professor of computer science at Northwestern University and director of the Center for Advancing Safety of Machine Intelligence. Anyone listening to this has interacted with AI at least a dozen times today. It's in your email, it's on social. You go to buy anything, you go to Netflix, that's all AI. It's all looking at you, characterizing you,
figuring out what you want and trying to hand it to you.
AI models have become more powerful at a blistering rate over the last few years. They are increasingly better at making recommendations and answering questions and giving answers that are more nuanced, insightful, and accurate. And you don't need to ask ChatGPT or DeepSeek whether this is a big deal.
Some frame this progress in terms of a race by companies to achieve AGI, that is, artificial general intelligence. A breakthrough that would give machines an intelligence indistinguishable from that of humans. It's one thing to be a smarter and more transparent chatbot, but acquiring general intelligence is something else altogether.
Just a few years ago, when we asked an AI researcher whether AGI was on the horizon, he said, no way, not in his lifetime. Replicating the intelligence of the human brain was too challenging. After all, it took evolution billions of years to produce it. But now some experts are changing their minds. Whether the arrival of DeepSeek has significantly reshaped the race to produce thinking machines remains to be seen, but by some measures, it is a game changer, says Dr. Hammond.
It's both a technology game changer and a business game changer. It's a technology game changer in that DeepSeek really is an example of doing something that we thought was really, really expensive and doing it in a way that's expensive, but not outrageously expensive. Then as a business, it means that you don't have to invest in a massive infrastructure in order to build something new. I think the issue of us versus China in this instance is a fascinating one, in that we put together the conditions that would force this company to innovate. That is, we limited access to the fastest, best NVIDIA chips, and so they had to use chips that weren't as good. And when you're limited, you have to figure out a way around the limitations. So they figured out how to program them better. They figured out how to have the overall systems be more efficient. All these things because we limited them. That's an interesting part of this, is that we were worried, and so we limited, and we created the innovation that we were worried about.
There was an article in the MIT Technology Review that suggested that DeepSeek's innovations might serve as the blueprint for models going forward. Does this mean that the Chinese AI model will be the prototype for all future models?
There's always a moment. There's always a moment as technology evolves where something will happen and you'll think, oh, this is it. This is the future. That's what happened with OpenAI November 30th, 2022. And we have a hard time envisioning something else until the something else comes. And with DeepSeek, DeepSeek has defined a path towards the future. There will be other paths, and there will be branches. And for me, the thing that's the most interesting about what the future will bring is not so much improved performance of the individual language models, but in fact how well they interact with us and with all of the technologies we already have. And even there, I think DeepSeek is in a lovely position, where DeepSeek is designed to be downloaded, to be changed, to be augmented, to be improved. And OpenAI's technologies, not so much so. They're within their walled garden.
So this is kind of the democratization of AI in a way that now you'll see it.
Ironically, the Chinese have given us the democratization of AI. And also ironically, OpenAI was always supposed to be open, and it never was. But DeepSeek is open, and that really does mean that that there are going to be more people, more groups, individual companies that are going to be able to develop the technology on their own using DeepSeek as a framework. And even if they don't use DeepSeek at itself, using the methods that DeepSeek used is going to change the nature of the way we're viewing these things.
Okay, so if you had to explain what the difference is, why DeepSeek is important, you know, how would you explain that, you know, that something that a non-expert could comprehend?
DeepSeek has two dramatic innovations. The first was what we call a mix of experts. That is, instead of training one thing to do it all, let's train dozens, and each one will do a little thing, and then you have to coordinate them. And DeepSeek was able to build out
was able to do that in a way that allowed it to use less energy, less space, less time, less compute power. The other thing it did was that they decided, instead of training through examples, which takes people, they developed what's called a reinforcement learning model. And the reinforcement learning model is you let the thing do its job and you get its output, and then you say to the output, yay or nay. And they have an automated mechanism for saying yay or nay, which means it could learn how to reason without explicitly being told exactly how to reason.
This may seem like an obvious question, but maybe we should clarify terms relevant to the development of artificial intelligence. What do we mean by intelligence now? And, you know, I work in SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and people will ask, well, what do you mean by intelligence? And for us, you know, if you can send a radio signal, if you can build a radio transmitter, we define you as being intelligent. It's an operational definition. It's very straightforward. But when you're talking about AI, what do you mean by the I part?
The argument about what is considered artificial intelligence really flows from the argument about what is considered intelligence in general. And for me, the definition of AI is systems that perform actions that if they were performed by a human being, we would consider them intelligent. And so language understanding and generation is certainly one of those. The ability to predict the future, which we do all the time. The ability to explain the past is one of those. And the ability to look at what's going on around you in the present and characterize it. And then on top, decision making, problem solving, planning. And so intelligence isn't one thing. And it was never even one thing for us. We have this notion of even intelligence at the analytic level, intelligence at the intuitive level, emotional intelligence. And so right now it's, can it pass these tests? And it's like, well, that's not really a good test. But is it conversational? Man, that's a fantastic test. It's the notion of what will be, when we will say, oh, this is genuinely intelligent, is going to be a mix of technical questions and emotional ones.
Let's step back a bit and look at what some see as, if you will, the roadmap, the bigger picture where AI is going, and that's the creation of artificial general intelligence. You know, how would you explain artificial generalized intelligence to that person sitting next to you on the train?
Artificial general intelligence, I mean, the notion is straightforward. Have we created a machine that's as smart or smarter than we are? And if it is, we're at least in the ballpark.
Yeah. So is AGI really nearly here? Am I going to see it coming across the horizon? Am I going to read about it in tomorrow's newspaper?
2.5 years ago, I thought I would not live to see AGI. I now believe I will live to see AGI. A lot of people don't believe that.
Okay, but will we actually recognize when AGI is here?
There's not going to be a moment where it's like, ping! It's intelligent. It's a spectrum. And there will be places where systems are more or less intelligent. And I think the thing that's the most exciting is that we are going to learn about our own selves as these things change. And they will make mistakes in systematic ways that are different than the way we make mistakes. So they will have their own intelligence and their own reasoning fallacies. And it will be exciting to see that. But there's not going to be a moment and then everything's intelligent.
Can you tell me then, what are the stakes here?
The stakes here are who is going to be building the different models you interact with. And from a business perspective, what do they want out of that interaction? And it's easy to turn all of those interactions into something malevolent. It's equally as easy to make them purely beneficial. But it's a decision that we have to make. And it's not a matter of just who's going to win. It's what are they going to do with that win?
I'm sure that the government in particular must have dreamt up some nightmare scenarios about what happens if we, quote-unquote, lose the race here to AI. Can you maybe give one example of the kind of apocalyptic result they may see from not being number one in the AI game?
Straightforwardly, people who use recommendation systems, Netflix, Amazon, LinkedIn, Facebook, they're all recommending things for you. And that means that your decisions are within the context of those recommendations. But if I have control over those recommendations, then I can move your thinking. And in fact, it's pretty easy. And with a combination of pure recommendation and being able to generate, I can not only move your thinking, I can move your thinking that's unique to you. And I can bring you someplace by giving you a series of articles that take your thinking over there. And the concern is, depending upon who's going to run that, we will have systems that will actually co-opt our thinking. And do we want companies to do that? Do we want governments to do that? Who do we want to do that? And I think that's what's at stake.
Is that what concerns you?
Every single day.
Really?
I'll tell you my nightmare scenario. If I were a sentient, highly intelligent piece of software, I would not take over your weapons. I'd take over Amazon's recommendation systems, so I would control what you read. I'd take over Netflix, so I control what you see. I would take over eHarmony, so I can control who you marry. And that's the concern that people have. That's the thing that you should be concerned about.
You know, one thing that strikes me as possible is that the 21st century will be remembered not for any of our particular technical developments, except for being the century in which we invented our own successors. Is that too pessimistic?
I think that thinking of AI as our successor is incredibly pessimistic, because it's not a thing that will happen on its own. It's a thing that will happen based upon our decisions. And the moment we decide that we're going to build AI systems that will reason for us, that's the day we lose. That's the day we lose. The day we decide that we're going to build AI systems that work with us to amplify us, that's when we win. And it's a question of which way we're going to go. But this is a choice. It's not imposed upon us. It's a choice.
Christian Hammond, thanks so very much for speaking to us. You may be the last human we interview, but I've really enjoyed talking with you.
It's been a lovely time for me as well. And I hope you don't worry too much.
Christian Hammond is a professor of computer science at Northwestern University, and he is the director of the Center for Advancing Safety of Machine Intelligence. And that brings us to the big picture so far in this show. Our question for this skeptic check was, is the Chinese AI model DeepSeek a game changer in the world of AI, as the buzz around it would suggest? And to reflect on that question, we're bringing in producer Brian Edwards along with Seth, of course. Brian, you want to take the first shot at that? What do you think?
Yeah, it sounds like everything that we have heard so far, that yes, DeepSeek seems to be as big of a deal as everybody was saying that it is. It is faster, it is cheaper, and it is open source. People are able to peek under the hood and see things about how this AI was working in ways that they couldn't with any other model. It's important to note that Christian did say that, you know, this is maybe just one important development among many that are going to come, but it certainly is a big development in the AI world.
It's, of course, technically important what's going on here, and also quite interesting, but it also has, if you will, strategic implications because of our relationship to China. Are we now going to have an AI gap? I kind of wonder about that.
You know, to put this in another big picture and to give a sense of just how fast this technology is moving, while we were producing the show, there was a big conference in Paris about the future of AI that raised the questions of its possibilities, but also safety issues. And Brian, you were following that conference, and what were some of the highlights?
Yeah, absolutely. World leaders gathered at this conference past iterations had been about safety, but this conference was focused much more on how to accelerate AI, how to get around the things that are preventing it from moving faster and getting bigger. The U.S. expressed that it's not particularly interested in any regulations on AI, and many European leaders, many who have expressed skepticism in the past about the speed at which AI is being developed, seem to be indicating that they are falling in line with that idea as well.
So the question really is, to what extent is AI going to change the trajectory, the future trajectory of humanity? I think that the next big inflection point, and we may already have reached it, is where we allow the machines to develop the next generation of machines. That's already taking place to some degree. But eventually, when the machines really have very little contact with humanity anymore, and it's just all about the machines.
Sometimes a discussion with an AI scientist about the future of the field can seem reminiscent of classic sci-fi. Both address the consequences of creating machines with human intelligence and the possibility that they turn against their makers. What might be surprising is which sci-fi movie continues to be relevant today.
It was the machine, Sarah.
I don't understand.
Defense network computers. New. Powerful. Hooked into everything. Trusted to run it all.
What role does science fiction play in preparing us for the future?
It's Skeptic Check, our regular look at critical thinking on Big Picture Science. In this episode, we are going into the deep seek.
Hollywood movies have tackled the theme of runaway artificial intelligence.
Films like Ex Machina and 2001, A Space Odyssey, are like fever dreams that let us play out, often tragically, the consequences of building super-intelligent machines.
But one anxiety-riddled movie about the rise of the machines has remained surprisingly durable over the years. You could say that its message is as indestructible as its title character.
I'm a friend of Sarah Connor. I was told that she's here. Could I see her, please?
No, can't see her. She's making a statement.
I'll be back.
The Terminator movies are so bound to the iconic image of stone-faced Arnold Schwarzenegger wreaking havoc in a leather jacket and dark glasses that we may forget that these movies, the first set and released in 1984, were partially about the dangers of runaway AI.
AI is actually quite hard to illustrate. I know this sounds very basic, but there are a lot of articles about it, and you need a cool illustration. And the red-eyed Terminator, with all the fake skin melted off, is very, very powerful. And Skynet, just that word, is a very, very powerful shorthand for explaining a certain idea of AI. So essentially, it's not necessarily the most prescient, but it's just people know it, and so it becomes a self-perpetuating thing. I'm Dorian Linsky. I'm an author and podcaster.
with its killer robots and rogue AI system, Dorian Lynskey writes in his book, Everything Must Go, The Stories We Tell About the End of the World. The Terminator films landed as the latest in a long history of art reflecting public fear about what happens when technology gets away from us. But movies generally reflect our anxieties, right? It's not like they're prescient.
Before we get to what the first two Terminator films got right and what they may have missed about the dangers of superintelligent machines, our producer Brian Edwards sets the scene for his conversation with Dorian. Brian, for listeners who may have never seen the Terminator movies, what are they about?
It was a ton of fun to get to watch a couple sci-fi movies for the show. Just in brief, we're mostly talking about Terminator 1 and Terminator 2, as James Cameron would intend it. So Terminator 1, we have Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Terminator, a robot sent back in time from a dystopic future where Skynet, a sentient AI, has taken over and destroyed the world to stop the mother of the resistance. Kylo Reese, one of the leaders of the resistance in the future, is also sent back in time to protect her from Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Terminator.
Well, Brian, as I recall, in Terminator 1, there's this threat from this synthetic intelligence, and, eventually the humans prevail as they always do. What about Terminator 2? What was the basic idea there?
You've got that right about the first one. The synthetic intelligence is still around in the second one, still attempting to stop humanity from defeating it in the future war. And we've got a couple Terminators sent back this time. This time Arnold's good. He gets to be the hero of the movie, fighting against a nigh-indestructible T-1000 Terminator. So in summary, this is a future in which AI machines have taken over the world and are trying to exterminate humanity.
So what role does sci-fi play in preparing us for the future? After all, the visions offered by two splashy arrivals in 1984 seem contradictory. That of one of the first personal computers, the almost quaint Apple Macintosh, and the dystopian metal contraptions that terrorize us in The Terminator.
We've had anxieties about machines going back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Samuel Butler's Erewhon is a famous kind of anti-machine novel. Carol Čapek's RUR, the play which invents the word robot, is about artificially intelligent, sort of humanoids rising up. So the fear predates the technology, and therefore as soon as computers sort of arrive in a big way after the Second World War, you start getting science fiction about the computer. And then as soon as artificial intelligence launches as a field in the 1950s, that gets folded into it. So by the time James Cameron was writing The Terminator, there's a really long history of science fiction about dangerous machines, and it's sort of static machines like computers, or humanoid machines like robots. And actually what Terminator does is it combines both. You've got the Terminators and you've got Skynet. It's the computer and the robot together as a joint threat.
Yeah, I guess we were, smashing machines back in the days of the Luddites. We do have a long history of having fears about machines and deciding that maybe we should smash them before they're going to disrupt life too much for us.
And Samuel Butler's writing about, we will invent the machines that will replace us. And he's writing in the middle of the 19th century, long before there was any such thing as AI, there was any remote possibility that such a thing could happen. So that's what science fiction often does, as it did with the atomic bomb, is that it imagines the danger long before the danger actually exists.
I think there's a line in the movie about kind of how all the technology has gotten away from us.
They say it got smart. A new order of intelligence. Then it saw all people as a threat, not just the ones on the other side. It decided our fate in a microsecond. Extermination.
Do you feel that, bringing up these fears, these kind of very dystopian fears about these types of machines, does that feel more prescient now than maybe it even did at the time?
Well, the thing about AI and science fiction is that it's invariably about superintelligence, also known as like the intelligence explosion, the idea that AI would exceed human intelligence and essentially make its own decisions. And actually, most of the people who worry about AI are not worried about that as much as unaligned AI, what they call sort of unfriendly AI. So it's not that it has a mind on its own and it decides that it hates humans, but as is kind of suggested, and it's really quite ambiguous how Skynet works. I've actually done quite a lot of, even with the novelization of Terminator 2, trying to work out exactly why Skynet does that, you know, and sometimes you get the impression that Skynet essentially becomes sentient and evil, i.e. becomes too human. And then another implication is that it's actually just been badly programmed. So it's designed to wipe out human evil, but it decides that all humans are evil and therefore carries it out its job too well and kills sort of friends as well as foes. And that reflects more accurately what a lot of kind of AI doomers are concerned about. That it won't have a mind of its own, but that it has just been told to do the wrong things. It has been carelessly programmed. It will pursue what it thinks are the correct goals, but with consequences that we have not intended.
And that feels like a great kind of differentiator between the first and the second movie, where in the second movie, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Terminator, comes back, but he is a good guy this time, and he is, you know, fighting against another Terminator who is, you know, stronger and newer, and now the threat to humans. And it does feel like one interpretation of that could be that, you know, this technology can be good or bad, just depending on how we program it.
And this is actually a part of science fiction about computers, robots, and AI going back to Carol Chapek's Robots or HAL in 2001, there is often an ambiguity about whether the machines have developed their own self-interest or if it's the humans' fault for the way that we've built them, the what we have asked them to do and how easily that can go wrong. So therefore, a lot of the time what we're looking at is a critique of humans rather than a fear of the machines. It's like we have built these things that will destroy us. It is not like an invading alien species, like an Independence Day. It's like, well, we did this.
Do you think that there's almost been a bit of a underestimated nature when it comes to some of these movies? I think that the technology is often so either antagonistic or removed from humans, where in reality, I think the tension that we have right now is a lot of people are nervous about how integrated a lot of these AI technologies are moving into our lives. Do you see that the movies were hitting on that tension at all, or is this maybe a thing that, you know, reality maybe branched off from some of our fears that we were having?
No, I think that's in the Terminator movies, that machines themselves are dangerous. You know, that actually a lot of the reasons why the Terminator is able to pursue Sarah Connor in the first movie is through things like Walkmans and answering machines. Like, there is a sense that machines, even when just like incredibly everyday, our reliance on them can be dangerous, although not at that point, it's with AI per se. But I think with later movies, you do get more of a sense that we are so reliant. I mean, Terminator 3 is a bad movie, and it kind of destroys the premise of the first two movies. But what's quite funny is that you can't kill Skynet by destroying a microchip. You can't, you know, by the basic processor, you can't kill it because it's online, it's replicated, it's everywhere.
So in Terminator 1 and Terminator 2, we have a couple different characters, first Kyle Reese, then Sarah, who are essentially coming from the future to try to warn people, Cassandra-type characters. How do those warnings, how would you say that those types of situations compare to people's current anxieties about the future of AI and how we're integrating those technologies into our lives?
Well, we've always had those figures, that Norbert Wiener, the father of cybernetics, and an early sort of skeptic of AI, and lots of warnings about what happens if we give the machines too much power, or we tell them to do the wrong things. And that seems very prophetic. You've got people now like Geoffrey Hinton, one of the pioneers of large language models, who went to work for Google and recently quit because he was terrified by the advances in AI. So we do have these real-life Cassandras. And what we also have is a strange kind of dissonance within the minds of people who work in AI, is that a lot of people are scared of what it might do, and they don't quite know how to ensure that you don't get dangerous, unaligned AI, but they keep doing it. And you've had quite a few of these figures that have been compared to who worked at the Manhattan Project. They were scared of the atomic bomb, but they felt that they had to finish it. And they had different motives. Some thought, well, look, it's going to happen anyway, and we better make the bomb before Nazi Germany. So some people think, oh, well, we better be ahead of China or Russia or whatever in terms of AI. And that's obviously come to a head with the DeepSeek thing. And then you have people who, they just want to solve the puzzle. There is a certain degree of hubris and excitement where it's just like, but if knowledge is out there, then we just have to pursue it. And some people just want to make a lot of money. But what you have, therefore, is it's not quite the enthusiasts and the skeptics or like the boomers and the doomers. You actually have those two competing impulses in the same brain. Someone like Sam Altman of OpenAI has talked about his fear of AI, when, of course, that is the substance of his whole business. And people haven't quite worked out how to resolve that. Not that many people seem entirely confident that the things they're working on won't go wrong in some manner.
It seems that if one was to, you know, take the advice of the films, it seems that, you know, they seem to eventually land on, you know, desperate individuals doing everything they can to just destroy the machines. And it seems like they don't focus a lot on the idea, you know, putting in guardrails or trying to reprogram or redirect it into a less dangerous path.
I mean, there are some AI doomers who say that that's exactly what you should do. You should just stop all AI and do what Miles Dyson, the inventor of Skynet, does in Terminator 2, which when he's told what his invention will end up doing, he sort of destroys it before it can do that. And that is a serious argument that some people are making, that you should just sort of stop all AI development before it gets out of control.
So finally, zooming out big picture here, we've talked about ways I think that these movies and other pieces of art have and have not predicted the future and technologies that were to come. But what is the great value of movies or art in attempting to predict these things, whether they do hit the mark or not?
I think AI is actually a really clear case of the value of fiction. That if you go all the way back to Frankenstein and you've got HAL from 2001, you've got Skynet, this is the language that we use. Even developers will often use that language. There's a huge relationship between the scientists and science fiction. And the goal, I think, is never particularly to predict, although sometimes some of this stuff ends up being really prescient. It's to express our concerns. So it's always like, on the technical side, this stuff is always, it's right and it's wrong at the same time. But on an emotional level, I think it always carries some truth.
Dorian Linsky, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Brian.
Dorian Linsky is the author of Everything Must Go, the stories we tell about the end of the world.
This show is thanks to the fully human, so far, abilities of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am Molly Bentley, the executive producer of Big Picture Science.
And I'm Seth Chostak, senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. We'd like to give a big thanks to our listeners and to our Patreon supporters.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Skeptic Check, our regular look at critical thinking on Big Picture Science, examines how our imagined AI future is panning out and is called Into the Deep Seek.
Allá, viene una tormenta.
What did he just say?
He said there's a storm coming in.
I know.
Skeptic Check is brought to you thanks to a generous grant from the Trimberger Family Foundation. At the Trimberger Family Foundation, we hold that skepticism is a lamp that lights the way to truth. Trimberger.
Funding for KSDP is made possible in part by the King Cove Corporation, operating the Fleets, Inn Hotel, the Heart Lakes Apartments, and the Last Hook Off Tavern. The King Cove Corporation is a proud sponsor of KSDP.